Welcome to another episode of Moments That Rock, part of the Pantheon Media Group of podcasts, which basically is 60-plus really good music-based podcasts. I'm your host, Tony Michaelides. We're here each week to share Moments That Rock. Today's guest is an old colleague of mine from a long time ago at Island Records. He was a press officer, went off to start his own company with his colleague, and pretty much since then has been very active, writing especially. He's come up with this brilliant book, The Island Book of Records, the first edition, 1959 to 1968. His name is Neil Storey, and we'll get him to talk a little bit more about it. So, as the jingle says, who are you? Well, I know who he is, because I've known him for God knows how long. His name's Neil Storey. He was a colleague of mine at Island Records in 1978, when we were doing regional promotions. We all got laid off, then he went to work in press. So I'm kind of reading you his bio, but we'll kind of cut to the chase, because he's just released an amazing book, which has taken him about 200 years to write, hasn't it, I think? You kind of started in the earlier 70s at Island Records, didn't you, as a sales rep?
Yeah, well, actually, I started at EMI before that, and I was 2 years at EMI, but involved with Island because EMI sold in to the record shops all the Island new releases. So as a consequence, you know, one of the earliest ones I was involved in that particular thing was Bob Marley, The Wailers, Catch a Fire. So I kind of go back a decent amount of time. And then after 18 months or so of working with EMI, I got offered a job at Island to become part of a sales force that they were setting up. And so that's really how I kind of accepted the Island shilling, or sixpence as it probably was at that time.
And then you just morphed straight out of regional promotion straight into press, didn't you? You didn't leave, really.
Well, no, I did leave, actually.
Oh, you did, right.
I was left. What happened was that I got this really crazy gig, because the sales force was being dismantled, and for some reason or other, they wanted me to go on the road with every single band they had on the road at the time. So that involved Bob Marley, Third World, Inner Circle were the first lot I went out with. And that was a tour with the Average White Band. I started in Brussels. So it was Britain and Europe. And essentially, I was advancing all the tours on behalf of the record company, meaning that all the right people went to the right gigs, and I was crisscrossing the country and bits of Europe literally on a daily basis from gig to gig. And I think, as you once wisely put it, you lived out of your car, and I did live out of my car.
I have the photos.
Indeed. Well, don't show them. But anyway, I lasted that for about just under a year. And then I came back into the office one day, I think it was a Friday, and I just finished the B-52s. B-52's first ever UK gigs. And if I'm remembering correctly, the last one of that run was in Scarborough. I'd never been to Scarborough. Anyway, it was in Scarborough. I drove all the way back, got into the office, and kind of wandered around seeing people. And John Knowles was my boss at that time. And he took me to one side and he said, look, I'm really terribly sorry, but we don't have any more bands for you to go on the road with. So you're being made redundant. Here's a check. That's what happened. And then I went and hid at my then girlfriend's house, and I got a letter. I mean, don't forget, this is so far beyond before emails and cell phones and all of that stuff. So I must have given somebody my or her address. Anyway, I got a letter saying, can you come into the office? And they let me use the car. And I thought, oh, shit, this means that I'm going to have to give the car back earlier than I haven't made any plans or anything. Anyway, so I got back into the office, walked into reception. They said, oh, hi. Rob Partridge wants to see you. And I thought, well, I didn't really know Rob particularly well at that point. So I went and sat down and had a chat to him. And he said, after about 10 minutes, he said, how do you fancy coming to work in the press office? He'd only just joined Ireland then. And I went,
Rob was a journalist, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was Melody Maker news editor. So I said, look, I don't know the back end of the Guardian from the front end of the Enemy. And he said, don't worry, you'll learn. Well, I didn't have anything else to do. So I said, all right, I'll come back. But there is a condition. I suddenly got my kind of balls back. And I said, can I keep my redundancy money? And so he said, well, I've got to go and see, I think it was Tom Hayes he had to go and see. Anyway, back he came and said, Tom says you can keep the money. So I thought, right, okay, I'm kind of a few quid up here. And that's how I kind of came back after the 2 weeks or 10 days or whatever.
They should have asked him to lay you off and then bring you back in a couple of months later. I remember we got laid off in 1980. So you went through into 81. So 82, you kind of started off in the press department.
The first half of the Unforgettable Fire Tour, I came off that and I actually took a completely different direction. I went to work in professional cycle racing and PR for that. So that was kind of like taking a bit of time out. And then Rob and I formed Partridge and Story in 1989, something like that. And so then there was that, the next involvement with Ireland. And we, as a PR company, you really want to start your PR company with artists or people who do interviews. We started with three clients, none of whom did interviews. Bob Marley because he couldn't, for obvious reasons. Chris Blackwell because he didn't fancy talking to anybody, and Tom Waits because he really didn't fancy talking to anybody. Those were our first three clients.
So that was Partridge and Story. That morphed into Coalition, did it?
That became Coalition after a while, and then Coalition got pretty big. We became like the PR company to go to in the UK, and I left there. I'd taken on Nigel Kennedy. He decided that he wanted me to manage him. I'd never managed anybody in my life. But he, anyway, persuaded me. So I managed Nigel for, 4 years, 5 years? We had three number one albums, four number one albums. I don't know, something along those lines. He's a great fiddle player, but he's not the easiest of people. And so then I kind of went and sat on a beach in Brittany for a couple of weeks and realised I'd made myself completely unemployed. And I was pretty much unemployable as it was at that point anyway. And I got back to a telephone call from our lawyer saying, come and have lunch. You probably know lawyers only want to have lunch with you if they want something. It's true, isn't it? So anyway, so I went and we went through all the courses of lunch and nothing had been mentioned. I thought I completely miscued. And then he asked if I'd heard of this particular client of his, and because he was looking for someone to manage him. And so that was my next management stint. And that lasted, I think, 5 years. And then by that time I'd moved to France. And then he and I fired each other simultaneously, which is pretty good going. And that was, I was out of music at that point for quite a while. There wasn't anything else I really wanted to do. And then after a bit, this mad idea that has now resulted in a book kind of came to me. And I began very, very early kind of putting together what has now become the Ireland Book of Records.
But you did some other stuff before that.
Well, we kind of came up with this idea of doing book sets, which was basically a book on artist X or Y or Z, vinyl size with music. Mm. And we did a career retrospective for Jess Roden. We did a couple of things with Gemma Hayes, who's an Irish singer-songwriter. Then we did a huge set for Chris Wood of Traffic. Mm-hmm. And then we had various other ones in the fire, and we were researching. There was a Robert Palmer one. And then that didn't, for varying reasons, which I'd rather not go into, they didn't happen. And then as is really the same with any really small bespoke label, if you like, licensing masters becomes increasingly more difficult, increasingly more expensive. The majors really want their, I'm loath to use the word pound of flesh, especially in the current climate, but they really want their money, and they want it all. Everything has to be up front. So in other words, you're just losing money over hand over fist. And in the end, I actually put all of the projects that we were working on, a Head, Hands and Feet one, there was a Bronco one, there was something else with Jess Roden, I put them all on the back burner because, you know, financially, it just wasn't making any kind of sense. We were putting, if you like, too much time into something that was actually never going to really reap any rewards. And so that was really that part, that's answering that part of your question. But if anything, that led us into, you know, we'd established a really good format with the book sets and that vinyl size, beautifully, beautifully designed.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And so that really has led us into the Island book.
You're listening to Neil's story on Moments That Rock, telling us the story about the first edition of the Island Book of Records, 1959-68. Great stuff. We'll be back from more with Neil, more sneezes as well. Believe it or not, I edited a whole bunch out after this. This is volume one, obviously, isn't it? So what's the plan? Is this going to take you up till you're about 120?
Yeah.
How long did this take from its inception then?
Inception was 15 years ago, and it got real. It really got real, believe it or not, on the day that the Chris Wood book set came out, because that also coincided with, unhappily, the funeral for Kelly, co-founder of Spooky Tooth, Only Ones, and the rest of it. Now, Kelly was a really, really, really good chum, and I'd known him since I was 17, on and off, obviously, but we'd kind of become friends all over again and for quite a few years. And standing there in the church, it suddenly dawned on me, and this was like the, I'm loath to use the word, the light bulb moment, but it suddenly dawned on me, there would be no more conversations. There would be no more. He used to communicate by Skype a lot. So you'd be sitting there working away, and suddenly it's about, if you can imagine it the other way around, suddenly you're sitting there typing away, you're concentrating on X or Y or Z, you've got Skype running in the background, and then suddenly there he is, he's beaming in. And it doesn't matter how busy you were, it would end up, how you just end up talking about something. But Kelly was incredibly important in the early to mid 60s in terms of the fact that he was there when you remember the early days of the band and the bootlegs that were coming out of Big Pink and all of that kind of stuff, where there were people bringing reel-to-reels, this is not cassettes, reel-to-reels, back from America. So he'd be up there at the cottage when Eric Clapton would arrive with a reel-to-reel of whatever these recordings were from Big Pink. And this is the band's influence on British contemporary music at that time. So Kelly was there and he was able to talk about it firsthand. So standing there at the funeral, you realise that that ain't going to happen again.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that was really, if there was a pivotal moment for this to really come into focus, it was that.
Before you actually physically started, did you approach the hierarchy at Ireland and get royal approval? And
well, no, I didn't, because I didn't feel I needed to approach anybody. Firstly, I don't work for them. Secondly, why would I go cap in hand asking them to do something that is based on my own archive? Mm. So, you know, every image you've seen, every album cover, every 45, 99.9% of them are drawn from my own archive. So why do I need to ask anybody's permission to do something like that? You know, I'm writing about records that they own the musical rights to, but, and they're illustrated with the covers that in many instances are still there gracing those album sleeves. However, they don't put out records that look as manky as, you know, mine from the early 60s to the late 60s, with chewed off corners and all the rest of it. So in that respect, no, I didn't. And if I didn't have a particular album cover, there's two or three other collectors who I know who do or did. If there's somebody who's got tickets to a gig that I wasn't at, therefore I don't have, then, you know, a lot of people have, when they found out, began finding out about this, became incredibly supportive, very, very helpful, and offering all manner of, oh, would this be of any use to you? You know, amazing, amazing stuff. Mm. And so, you know, the idea has been to make it as definitive a work as is possible. And I think, well, it's for others to say whether we have or not, obviously, but it feels to me like it's as, I don't think we could have made it any better.
No, well, you've done a great job. So what's the master plan? This is 59 to 68. Is the next one like 69 to 78?
The idea really was to do about 100 albums per book. And so the next one will actually be less than 100. It will be 69 to 70. That's, if you like, the Pink years. We're already at the Pink years with the first John Martin, both the Nirvana albums, the first two Traffic albums, and so on. But 69 through into late-ish 70, which was when the Pink Rim label was introduced. The plan is that now we've got Volume 1 done and dusted, we've already started on Volume 2. Volume 2 will cover the years 69 and 70. It'll be less than 100 albums, but you've got all the beginnings of those great gatefold sleeves. They all need a lot of space to live within the book. There's an awful lot to talk about. There's an awful lot of people talking about, you know, you can't give, I don't know, in the course of the Crimson King, you can't give that just a couple of spreads. You've got to run more than that. There will also be other features. There'll be a second Guy Stevens feature, for example, because he kind of came back into play. He produced, although it was never really released, he produced some of the early Bronco material, Mott the Hoople, obviously. And so he plays a major part. Then there will be a little bit about Blind Faith, because Traffic had split up at the end of 68. There will be, what else will be? Martin Lamble, Fairport's drummer, was killed. So there's another little section on that. So it's all the book, the bits of the book within the book. So that will take us up to the end of 1970 when the Pink Rim label comes in with Cat Stevens and Alan Bam. And then volume three will be 71 to 72. Volume four will be 73, 74, maybe 75. I haven't really made my kind of mind up about that. And then eventually it'll go up to 1989.
So that's when it's going to end, 89.
For two reasons. One, it is the end of the, if you like, Island analog era. Secondly, 1989 was when Chris sold Island to what is now Universal. So it feels like a logical stopping point.
So did you reach out to a multitude of people that go back over the years for the book?
I reached out to as many people as I could think of. And 99.9%, I think there's only one person, or is it two, who've actually declined to be interviewed. One person didn't turn up for their interview, whose name I'm not going to name. So that was a bit of a disaster. But everybody else has been incredibly helpful, incredibly kind, and willing to talk. You know, sometimes I've goofed up taping somebody and I've said, you know, do you mind if we do it all over again? Of course not. They make time. It's been an amazing experience. And also hearing some of the mad stories. Mm-hmm. You know, it's never ending. I mean, did you know, for example, that the first Island gold disc, it wasn't for a Cat Stevens album or a Traffic album. It was for one of the Rugby Songs albums.
Great.
You didn't know that, did you?
No, I didn't.
Nor did I. And on the here's another one for you. This one David Bettridge told me. He said, you know, you're looking at the sleeve of the first Island UK album, Keith and Enid Sing. And he said, you know that isn't Keith and you know that isn't Enid. So I kind of looked at him blankly and I went, no, I'd no idea. And he went, well, it isn't, because we didn't have a picture of them. So what we did was we roped in Esther Anderson, who was about to be a Bond girl, who was Chris Blackwell's girlfriend at the time, and a guy called Winston Stoner. You'd know him better, possibly, because he co-founded Busher Brown's sauces and Jamaican sauces and condiments. And, you know, curry mixtures and the rest
of it. His name was Stoner from Jamaica.
Yeah. Winston was also in The Harder They Come and Cool Runnings. He was a film star as well. Anyway, they were the two people on the front of the album cover, if you like, pretending to be Keith and Enid.
And that concludes part one of curator Mr. Neil's story, compiling the Island Book of Records, 1959 to 1968. Highly recommend it. Go and check it out. We'll be back with more stories from Neil in a few weeks to come. You've been listening to Moments That Rock with me, Tony Michaelides, part of the Pantheon Group of Podcasts. Come back next week, subscribe, share, tell your friends, and make a grown man very happy.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.